Dr. Simeon Hine has been doing interesting work for years, originally getting his PhD from Washington State University in 1993 in sociology. He's been working with people and opening their minds. In fact, that's the title of one of his books, Opening Minds, A Journey of Extraordinary Encounters, Crop Circles, and Resonance. And if you hear that word a lot, know that he was ahead of the curve on this. He's been instructing people in the art of resonant viewing, as well as the scientific study of crop circles and other subtle energy phenomenon. In fact, it's very interesting to look at the world through the mind of Simeon Hine. And we'll do that with Dr. Hine next. We'll explore these crop circles and his unique view of what he thinks is creating them, as well as what he thinks the byproduct is of their creation. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, my name's Ian Punnett. Dr. Simeon Hine, it's a pleasure to chat with you, although I have to tell you right up front, the DVD that I was expecting of your work never arrived. So I've spent a lot of time on your website, but I'm really interested in the work you've been doing. So I hope that I can one day take a look at that personally. Good morning. How are you?
Good afternoon. Morning, Ian. Thanks for having me here today. And, you know, just to straighten that out, I think you're talking about Larry Noonan's DVD, Circle Speak.
Yes.
I think he's produced a wonderful DVD about crop circles, and we'll find a way to get that to you pretty soon.
Yeah, well, because there's so much about this which remains a mystery, although we learned a lot more about crop circles, certainly some of the work that you have done that's on your website, and we'll get back to that in just a minute. And I also reserve the right to return to resonant viewing, because I find your descriptions and your classes about that to be very interesting, the way you differentiate between resonant viewing and remote viewing, and how you teach one and how you see what the dynamics are of resonant viewing. I find that very intriguing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And especially, you're teaching classes all over the world. I saw pictures of your Japanese classes.
Right. I've been teaching resonant viewing in Japan since 2003. And we also teach our classes here in Boulder, Colorado. In fact, we're doing our intermediate class this weekend.
All right. So when you go to Japan, do you need an interpreter, or are you fluent in Japanese?
No, I have an interpreter, Ian.
Okay.
And these interpreters do a great job of kind of conveying some of these complex topics into Japanese.
I was going to say, because this is sometimes difficult stuff to talk about in English.
Yeah, that's right.
Your command of Japanese would have to be extraordinary,
right.
I imagine. How'd you make the transition from a sociology teacher into researcher in this way?
Well, Ian, what happened is, you know, I got a PhD in sociology back in 1992, as you mentioned. I used to teach statistics and social research methods. And a couple of years later, I heard a man named Dr. Courtney Brown talking on the radio, my local radio station here, about remote viewing. And this is an idea I'd never heard before. And he said that everybody had this natural innate ability to perceive non-local information, you know, get information about people and places and objects that were distant from them, that they couldn't get from their five physical senses. And he had written a book about this, and he was teaching classes at the Farsight Institute in Atlanta. And I was so intrigued by this idea, because partly I was so skeptical, based on my training as a sociologist, that anybody, you know, apart from a natural psychic could actually do something like that. And I went and took his class, partly just to see if it was true that people actually had this innate ability to do remote viewing. And I found after a few days that not only was I getting results that I really couldn't explain, but that everybody in the class was getting really amazing results. They could actually describe pictures that were in folders that they hadn't seen ahead of time and draw pictures of them, describe them in great detail. And when I did this for the first time, I really said, you know, there's something going on here that I didn't learn about in my 27 years in school, and I need to find out more about this. And that's how I made this whole transition into the world of subtle energy science and a lot of the topics that, you know, that we talk about on Coast.
What was that first breakthrough experience? What did you draw, or what were you able to capture with remote viewing?
we were viewing the target of Cancun, Mexico. And we had that picture that I'm sure many people have seen of all those hotels along the beach.
Right.
And I had drawn a picture of what looked like a beach with these hotels on it. And when we were given the cue to kind of move into the target and get closer, I began to hear people speaking Spanish inside these buildings. And I thought that I was just making this up. You know, I mean, we just have this blank sheet of paper and a protocol to follow in front of us. And I thought, well, I don't know what I'm getting here, but you're just supposed to pay attention to the process and be detached from the outcome. And I completed the session, and when I saw that picture, it was actually very close to the picture that I had drawn in my phase three drawing, at the stage where you draw pictures. And I had actually heard people speaking Spanish in my mind, and I saw the hotels there, and I said, wow, actually, I was there. It was almost like I was there in the remote viewing session. And that really made a big impression on me that actually I could do something that I didn't think I could do, but there I had done it. And a lot of other people in the class were too, and I really said, you know, there's something really important going on here that I need to understand. And since that time, I've been, you know, studying the topic of remote viewing and now teaching it as well.
Well, but let me back up for a second. So sure. Why isn't that just vivid imagination?
Well, you know, you're right, Ian. If you just did this once, you might say, well, you had a lucky guess. But if you see yourself doing this repeatedly day after day, the course that I originally took was an 8-day course. If you see yourself getting these repeated results, that is the hallmark of some sort of scientific effect going on. And, you know, that's what we're taught in science classes. If you see this effect repeatedly, then something's really going on that you need to pay attention to. There is always that debate. Is this just purely an answer you're getting by luck? Just the results are just purely by chance. But if that were the case, you'd expect to miss most of the targets, right, and only get some of them once in a while. But if you're getting good target contact every third target or something like that, that's well above what you would expect to get by chance, and that would show you that there's actually a real effect going on there. And especially seeing so many other people get the same results. These targets were done blind.
Right.
There really was no way. But, you know, your mind goes through all the possibilities. Maybe I saw the target somehow, or, you know, there's some contamination going on here. The information is leaking through. In fact, all the people at SRI where these techniques were originally developed, you know, 30 years ago, they had to kind of control for all these possible sources of information leakage that might kind of give you an alternate explanation of how someone could do that. But once you control for all those factors, you just have to conclude there's something else going on that you can't explain. The information is traveling through another pathway
right.
into your mind, into your awareness that is not traditional. It's not explainable by any traditional scientific idea that we know about.
Just, again, indulge me for a second. Have you ever submitted this back into the, you know, into the halls of academia from which you came?
Yes, I have from time to time. I did present some of this information at some sociology conferences. And I did get a receptive welcome from some of the younger students and, you know, recent graduates.
Okay.
But some of the older people are a little suspicious of this. And I got to tell you, Ian, a lot of books are written from academia trying to explain this phenomena away. In other words, rather than looking at it as potentially a real new scientific phenomena, the books that are written about this, the general approach is, why do people believe in weird things?
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of weird things that turn out to be fact 20 years later. People didn't believe in the Wright brothers either for the longest amount of time. I mean, think of all the scientific inventions that at the time were considered hoaxes. So I think it's very valid to take the other point of view rather than why do people believe in weird things. You also could take the point of view, is it possible there are other processes and new phenomena, or at least phenomena that we don't understand very well? Could those phenomena be going on and we just don't understand it yet? And that's the position I've been taking ever since I had my experience getting good target contact in remote viewing sessions.
What's the difference between that and an OBE?
You know, it seems to be a scale of contact. The OBE is really a situation where you're either leaving your body or having the perception that you've left your body. I think that remote viewing, or what we call resonant viewing, is kind of more a lightweight version of that. You're actually not going anywhere. It's more that you're using your body and your mind like an antenna to receive information. And it may feel from time to time that you're actually at the target site. And I know some of the military viewers that were in the government military remote viewing program actually think that it's like that. But what I suspect is really going on is that your conscious mind is so good at assembling all the information that comes into your senses every second, it's kind of recreating a virtual reality in your mind, and it feels like you're there. But I don't think you're actually physically there, at least not in the CRV type of protocol that we use, you know, the protocol that was invented at SRI that the military eventually used. It seems more that you actually feel like you're there. And in a very intense session, you get what we call bilocation. You actually feel like the room disappears around you, and you feel like you're at another target location. That happened to me once when we were doing a target about the destruction of the dinosaurs, and I actually ended up in what felt like a swamp. And I could actually see kind of like these creatures around. It was very strange. And then when I later found out this actually was a target about dinosaurs, you know, that was really quite astounding. But occasionally that does happen, like you feel like you're there. But I think, you know, OBEs, like they do more like at the Monroe Institute, where you're trained to kind of create that out-of-body feeling or maybe actually literally go somewhere. I think that's a little different than the remote viewing protocol, which is a little more, a milder version of that.
When you say not physically there, I would think the term more apt might be not psychically there. You're not, you know, I mean, would you describe going into that hallway in the hotel in Cancun and hearing people speaking Spanish? I would think in a way that you are psychically there, but you aren't physically there.
Right. I would agree with that.
Okay. And what's the difference? Does anybody use the term astral projection anymore?
Right. That's also a related phenomenon where you're actually projecting what we'd call your subtle energy body.
Right.
Again, same idea into a different location. The idea that you may be traveling around, maybe when you dream at night, into different places. And again, that's kind of, I believe, a more intense version of the remote viewing experience, rather than just staying here and receiving the information like people do on their radios. You're actually not going to the radio station. You're receiving the information. You actually might be able to project part of your subtle energy body into a different location and perceive those locations from that point of view.
I'll tell you a story. This used to happen to me when I was a little kid, and up until probably about the age of, I think the last time I remember it happening was about 16. I used to experience a kind of out of body sensation that would occur when I would go from, so oftentimes from extreme environmental conditions. For example, a cool night walking underneath a hot, bright, movie marquee back in the old days when they used to have the marquees that actually hung out over the sidewalks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, where you would walk and there would be a million flashing lights and it would be hot underneath the big marquee that would float out in front of the box office. And a couple of times that sort of thing would happen. I'd come out of a cool store and step outside into a bright, you know, hot parking lot. And I would have the feeling that, and I would have the visual ability, it would seem, to look down on top of myself. And I went through this probably a couple dozen times. And I would be able to sort of have a distant relationship with my physical presence, where even a friend of mine, I remember once punching me in the arm because he'd been talking to me and I hadn't been paying any attention to him because I was floating above, what felt like floating above myself, looking down at me. And I remember him hitting me in the arm, and only the sensation of him hitting me in the arm brought me back to my physical presence in my body. What does that sound like to you?
Well, you know, Ian, I've had that happen a couple times also in kind of different circumstances, but there was some sort of shock or something, and all of a sudden I felt like I was floating out of my body by a few feet.
Right.
And I honestly don't know exactly what that is. I've always wondered, is that just a perception of being out of my body, or is there some part of my awareness which really was out of my body? I don't totally know the answer, but it's really an interesting phenomena, and it's certainly, you know, related to what we're talking about here.
I once mentioned it to my mother when I was about 14 or 15 years old, and she looked at me with these saucer-like eyes, and she asked me to describe it again, and I did. And my mother, who is not prone to these kind of conversations, said to me, "That is so weird, because I used to have that same thing happen to me when I was a girl." When she was a little girl, she said, and her experiences went away during puberty. And she said, and I never had them again. And I haven't either. I mean, I think the last time I had it was 16. Well, and after that, I've never had them again. And I've wanted to have them again because I think they were fascinating.
They're kind of fun, yeah. Well, you know, we have those reports from people in hospital sometimes, you know, who have near-death experiences or giving birth or something. And they may die for a few minutes or just be under such stress that they kind of pass out. And they're later able to describe, like, the inside of the wall of the elevator or the outside of the building or something. There's no way they could have seen, you know, physically.
Sure.
And you have to wonder maybe that they were literally floating outside of their body in some way, you know.
Well, what's the difference between remote viewing and resonant viewing. Describe how you see that.
The difference is mainly in the way we look at it. You know, the idea of remote viewing is that you're here in the room somewhere, wherever you are, and you're viewing a distant object. But we know from quantum mechanics that, in a sense, there really is no distance, that everything is really different, you know, at a different frequency. And so the reason you can do remote viewing is because there isn't really anything that's remote. In other words, everything that is that exists in our universe gives off a frequency of energy. And by tuning into that frequency, you can pick up the energy, the information about that thing or person or place. And so we really think that what remote viewing is an ability for you to match the frequency of another object or person. And just like when you're tuning into a radio, you know, you tune into the station and boom, you know, the station comes through your radio. When you can tune into the resonance of different things, the information seems to spontaneously flow to you across this quantum field and into your awareness. And so it's more a form of resonance matching rather than remote viewing. When you think of it as remote viewing, then you think, well, how am I getting over there? You know, how is it possible for the information to get from there to here? But if you look at it more as a frequency, that everything is just kind of emitting its own kind of subtle energy radio signals, at least as an analogy, then it's not quite as much of a puzzle of how it's possible to do this in the first place. So it's more just the way we look at it rather than a different sort of protocol or a different method. It's just that we think of it more as a type of frequency matching, like a intergalactic radio, rather than as really you going somewhere else, your astral body projecting into a different location.
You're your own SETI project.
In a sense, yeah.
Okay. And so does everything then have a frequency? You use things with frequency, and I'm trying to understand that. Do you have, as opposed to people with energy, you're talking about even like waves from things?
Yes, everything that exists, period, has some sort of frequency at the location in the matrix of space and time. And this frequency, it seems, based on, you know, what we've seen, the human has the ability to tune into this through a process that I don't thoroughly understand, and I don't think anybody does. But somehow our subconscious can, through the nature of intent, tune into those different frequencies, and spontaneously the information appears in your awareness. You write it down in your paper, and it's like magic. You describe a non-local event or person or place.
When you say resonance in that sense, then is and frequency, I would think that frequencies of things, if not people, would have there'd be an element of decay to the energy that's expressed by a thing or a person, that over time that energy wave would diminish. So
yeah, that's a really good point, and it doesn't seem to happen that way, Ian.
Really?
Yeah, all the results seem to suggest that this non-local energy doesn't decay with distance, which has led a lot of researchers to suspect that it's not an electromagnetic signal, right?
Right.
I mean, the Coast show right now, if it's being emitted by some radio station somewhere, it's going to decay as it goes out from the Earth farther and farther into the solar system. But these remote viewing signals, these resonant signals, do not seem to decay with distance, and their experiments have been done with that. With the viewer Ingo Swann, when he viewed one of the planets as the Voyager mission, I think it was Uranus, he viewed a ring there before Voyager even got there. And they've done some experiments with putting viewers in submarines in the Pacific.
Sure, I've heard about those.
Yeah, and they didn't find that there was any decay in accuracy. Now, normally seawater is kind of an impediment to an electromagnetic signal, right? And you have to have these really long wave antennas for submarines to communicate with land-based stations. But
okay,
it doesn't seem that the viewers become any less accurate when you put them underwater.
Well, and partly I'm thinking about when you're remote viewing over time, you know, here you have, you know, you talked about going back into an ancient swamp. You would think that the energy from that swamp would have long since decayed and no longer exist. So how do you tune into that frequency of a place that existed millions of years ago?
Right. Well, what it suggests and is that time doesn't exist the way we think it does at some other level. That possibly, and I know this is a little difficult to understand logically, everything is happening at once in a parallel reality, and you're simply tuning into that reality. It's actually right next to you. You can't physically see it, but it's in a different space. And your subconscious can tune into it. But that does raise a lot of questions, but it does seem that all the events of the past and the future are already here right now, and that's how viewers are able to describe some of these events and sometimes predict even future events.
That means in a parallel reality, I can redo the first hour of the show.
Yeah, it almost suggests that you can things are happening in lots of different ways all at once.
All right, it's a big concept. We'll leave that there.
Okay.
But that brings us up to crop circles then, and remote viewing in the dark, and creating crop circles, and knowing which ones are faked and which ones are real, and what comes real out of even the faked ones. Next with our very good friend here, and I'm loving this conversation, Dr. Simeon Hine on Coast to Coast AM. So we're talking with Dr. Simeon Hine, who's the author of a book called Opening Minds, A Journey of Extraordinary Encounters, Crop Circles, and Resonance. We've been talking about resonant viewing and other subtle energy phenomena. But how do you tie that together with crop circles? How are those two things connected? Well, we'll talk about that coming up next, and also probably touch on his new book that's coming out, Planetary Intelligence, 101 Easy Steps to Energy, Well-Being, and Natural Insight, next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Well, we're opening our minds with Dr. Simeon Hine, and we're grateful for all of this very interesting information about crop circles, which I'll get to in just a moment. Let me just also ask you, when's that book, Planetary Intelligence, coming up?
Well, Planetary Intelligence is actually available right now as an ebook download, but the printed version should be available around January 2006.
And they can link up to the ebook download at your website?
Right. They can go to the Opening Minds website and click over to Planetary Intelligence and, download the ebook. They can just sign up on our mailing list, and I'll let them know when the printed version is available.
Who is Mount Baldy?
Well, Mount Baldy Press is actually my own self-publishing company that I started.
Right.
And it used to be actually the Remote Viewing Institute, which we now changed to a federally recognized nonprofit, a 501c3. It's now called the Institute for Resonance. And people that take our resonant viewing classes, can actually take a tax deduction because we're a nonprofit.
But it's not named Mount Baldy because of a receding hairline.
No, actually, Ian, that is named after a mountain in near Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Okay.
We did a lot of remote viewing on this particular mountain back at the Farsight Institute because there was a lot of indication that there may be some extraterrestrial activity there, and I just thought it was kind of a neat name, and it became the name of the website and the Institute for a while.
I was just trying to understand.
That's right.
And I'm very interested in this idea, too, about some of the pictures I saw on your website of these crop circles.
Right.
And let's talk about this work, because what percentage of crop circles that have appeared, say, even on the Coast to Coast AM website or, around the world, what percentage of them are valid? What do you think is, how many of those are man-made hoaxes?
It's a big question, Ian, and let's rephrase that a little bit.
Please do.
Yeah. There was a time when I actually thought that people could not even make a crop circle. I mean, there was a lot of good evidence back in the 90s that it just was way too complex at night to do even something like that, the ones we see on the Coast to Coast website and on the Opening Minds website. And there was a time I didn't think it was possible to do that. I went over with a man named Ron Russell, taking one of his crop circle tours, which he gives every year. I went over in 1997 after learning about crop circles, doing remote viewing sessions on them. I was very curious about them. And going over there and seeing these huge patterns in English wheat fields, I just thought this was simply not something that people could do. I mean, the architectural firm said it would take 4 or 5 days in the daytime to make one of these, and no one had ever been seen making these. And Colin Andrews actually has a database of about 40 to 50 sightings of crop circles actually being formed in about 10 or 15 seconds of people up early hours of the morning. Now, those are all simple circles or groups of circles. But around the year 2000, I actually, and Ron Russell also, we were approached by so-called circle makers. And we thought these people were actually just faking this. We didn't think they could do anything, but they invited us out to actually watch them make a circle in the daytime, a paid internet advertisement where the farmer had been paid ahead of time.
Now, this is daytime.
So already
the conditions are a little bit different, but you had bit hard on the idea that these were all authentic. So
You
took the challenge.
I did take the challenge, Ian. I actually didn't want to believe that people could do this. I actually like the idea of the original kind of Colin Andrews, Terrence Meaden idea that this was something being produced by ionic plasmas, perhaps some sort of unknown Earth intelligence or extraterrestrials, which I actually believe those three forces are involved in some of the crop circles. I thought those explained, you know, those three phenomena explained all of the crop circles. But when I saw these individuals, this was actually Matthew Williams, make one in the daytime, you know, it was rather small, and he did a good job with it, but it was in the daytime, and I wasn't really convinced that that could really be applied to the pitch black that you get in the dark in England at night. But then I was invited by another group, and I wrote about this in Opening Minds. I have some pictures of that particular circle. I was given a shape ahead of time and told that I could watch a group make this at night. And I actually took them up on this challenge. I was just so curious. I didn't think they could do it, but they did. They did it very well, and I was really impressed with their technique. I found that at night they really had developed techniques for really working together as a group. And I later found out that these individuals and about 30 to 40 other individuals, at least in England, just talking about England, that they actually have been making crop circles for about 10 years. I began to know more and more of these people, and they began to trust me and share more of their information with me, and I began to see some of the books of their patterns, and I even got to see circles that hadn't been made yet, and lo and behold, they'd appear a couple weeks later, you know?
Right.
And I began to change my view of what was going on there, and I wasn't comfortable with it at first, and I know a lot of people are not.
How many people were making these crop circles in this community that you talked about?
About 30 to 40.
Wow. How many would show up in it? They would like send out like a mass email or something and say, hey, we're all gathering in such a place and we're going to make, you know, pattern 5B. I mean, is that how it would work? I mean, they knew what pattern they were going to make when they got there.
Oh, absolutely. These patterns are planned out very carefully ahead of time, week for week sometimes. And the fields are carefully selected according to other circles that have appeared in those fields in the past, the geography of the area. They'll consider how the shape will, you know, aesthetically kind of affect the whole field. And they take a lot of things into consideration. I was really impressed with their care and their sincerity. I actually thought these people were hoaxers, you know, guys that going out after right. night in the pub. That's what we had been told, and that's what I had been told by a lot of the researchers at a lot of these, you know, crop circle conferences. I thought that was true. What I actually found were people that believed that crop circles are what they call natural magic. They had been experiencing a lot of really weird stuff out there at night. And I began to realize these aren't hoaxers. These are kind of like natural magicians who know that crop circles really do attract a lot of really strange stuff, Ian, and stuff that we can't totally explain. And these crop circle artists are actually believers like us in crop circles, except that they're, at least in England, they're making a lot of them.
All right.
So to answer your question, I think in England, probably a lot of them are being made by people, if not most of them. As far as the rest of the world, I don't know.
80%, 90%?
Yeah, something like that, maybe even more.
All right. So,
but it hasn't always been that way. I'm just talking in the recent, last 10 years or so. Yeah.
I get it. Okay. Yeah. But so let's say 80 or 90% of those, let's just limit it to England. Who knows about India? Who knows about Asia? Who knows? But let's just say 80 to 90% are faked. Or they are created, not faked, but they're created. And they were avoiding detection. It was highly organized, but now we understand what it was. But you still think that 10% then are created by something else. What else is creating that other 10 to 20%?
There's a couple other sources. You know, back in the 60s in Australia, there were something called saucer nests. People would see UFOs and have UFO sightings. And the next morning they'd find that the reeds or other plant material was swirled down in the circle, and it became known as saucer nests. And actually some of the original so-called hoaxers, Doug and Dave, you might have heard of them, the guys from the pub,
right.
They actually were attempting to recreate what they had seen in Australia, which were apparently genuine circles, so to speak, created by UFOs or UFO propulsion systems. I've actually spoken to people that have either seen this or know people that have seen this themselves, actually witnessed this sort of event. A lot of lights flashing at night, and the next morning there's some sort of circle there. I think that explains a certain percentage of the circles in different parts of the world. This is also seen in New Zealand. So UFOs, even in this country, there's a wonderful book called The Secret History of Crop Circles by Terry Wilson. And he goes into the prehistory of crop circles. I mean, we're talking before the modern era, before the 1970s. You know, crop circles have been appearing for a long time. So they're not all explained by the recent rise of people making them. But the people who made them were actually attempting to imitate what they were seeing out there in the fields, which we don't know who or what was making that. So the human interaction with this actually grew out of the other phenomena. Yeah.
You mentioned some sort of Earth phenomena, too, perhaps, responsible for this?
Some people have suspected that some sort of Earth energy could actually affect the plants in some way. I don't have a lot of evidence that that's what's going on. But certainly that was a theory at the time we considered. You know, maybe this is coming from underground. Maybe it's not coming from above. And, of course, there's the original idea that came from a man named Terence Meaden that this was coming from so-called ionic plasmas, like kind of like a form of electrical discharge from the upper atmosphere, coming down rapidly to the Earth, creating heat and swirling, or creating an electrical charge and swirling the wheat down. And while that might have explained some of the simple patterns, you'd really be hard-pressed to kind of think that those really complex unforeseen nowadays are explained by that phenomenon. I can't really quite go there with that explanation. But maybe it did explain some of the simple ones in the, you know, maybe 10 or 20 years ago when people actually would witness some of these simple ones forming rather rapidly.
Tell me what you mean by natural magic.
The circle makers I've talked to believe that when you make a crop formation, that it attracts some sort of paranormal energy to the area. And that isn't totally far-fetched. People in subtle energy sciences like Dr. William Tiller call it a conditioned space. The circle makers believe that there's something magical about the space of a crop circle. And, of course, the evidence for that is when they're out there at night, they see balls of light, UFOs, and have strange anomalous experiences. Sometimes they encounter shadow people or their watches don't seem to work correctly, things like that. And then the next day, the rest of us come in as researchers and people that are interested in crop circles, croppies, as we're sometimes called.
Right.
And we have really strange experiences, like we did this summer near Silbury Hill and Avebury area. And the pictures, you know, of those circles are on my site. We had 3 days of camera and battery failure repeatedly. And I've seen this. I saw this for the first time in 1999 in a formation called the Devil's Den. My cameras and other equipment, we were using this static electricity meter to measure some of the static energy around the circle, thinking maybe the circles affect the static charge in the area. All that equipment stopped working, and someone came in with a GPS device, and his GPS device, which a few minutes ago it had 14 hours of battery life, all of a sudden it wasn't working. You know, these stories have been around for a long time, and I first experienced it in 1999. We experienced it just last August for 3 consecutive days where, you know, camcorders are showing a very strange amount of minutes left on the batteries. We had 3 lithium-ion batteries that would refuse to charge once they had been in a crop circle for about a couple weeks until they got back to the States. They worked again. They would not take a charge even, you know, when we went back to the hotel. This is why the circle makers call it natural magic, because they think you go out, you make a circle, do your best on it. They actually say prayers and incantations before they make their circle. They're not doing this as a joke. It's very serious for them. They're creating some sort of magical, positive effect for the planet. And when we go into the circles, we really experience something strange going on with our equipment, and occasionally people see balls of light, UFOs occasionally. So it's kind of, in a sense, magical, and I actually think of it more as a natural technology. It's almost like a spiritual machine or some sort of organic circuit that really creates effects that we can see occasionally, but we can't totally explain it.
These people who are making crop circles pray, to whom or to what? I mean, what do they pray about?
They say incantations for planetary healing, evolution, for people to experience positive effects and magic when they come into the circle the next day. Basically, that the circle itself will have a positive effect on the area and on the people that experience the circle. Basically, that this is going to create positive energy rather than just be a negative experience or a hoax. They really believe that these circles do something good for all of us, and that's what keeps motivating a lot of them to keep doing it. Not all of them, but a lot of them.
Are they Wiccans?
Some of them, absolutely, yeah. Some of them are definitely in that kind of school of thought.
Earth-based
pagans,
religion.
Yes. Some of them are just artists. A lot of them are artist pagans, if you can imagine that. They believe that there are magical energies in the earth that are unleashed by the process of making a circle. And I know this is a very different story than we've heard about them, but having met these people and kind of meeting up with them every year when I go over there, and having contact during other parts of the year, I've come to realize that they're actually a very serious group of artists that really believe that crop circles are important for our evolution in some way. And I tend to agree with them in the sense that a lot of us, our lives have really been changed in some way by being involved with crop circles.
Okay. I'm interested in this idea that they go out to create a crop circle and in doing so change the energy of their space there, and that in doing so then they attract a type of magical phenomena like balls of light or UFOs. Anybody talk about a kind of close encounter? Have any of these UFOs signaled them, given them kind of the, you know, if you flash your brights at somebody coming at you because they've got their brights on, and so they flash back to you, say, hey, I got the message, that kind of thing?
Yes, it can be very similar to that. There's a group of three circle makers who actually call themselves the Circle Makers. They're from London. And one of them relayed the story once that they were out in the field making a circle, and something came over the circle, very bright, and a light came down on them from this object, but it made absolutely no noise. Now, there's a lot of military activity in that area because you're right near Salisbury Plain, which is a big military operating area for the British military. They don't have all that much space in England, so those things are kind of close together. And you hear the helicopters coming over and the planes, but this object apparently made absolutely no sound. And they were so frightened by it, they hit the deck. And these are three grown guys that are used to being out at night in all sorts of circumstances.
I think they would be overjoyed. That would be the whole purpose of
doing
that.
Well, you would think so, yeah. But when it happens to you and you really don't know what this is, there was another case very similar to that I heard from a group of circle makers that went out into a circle intending to make a certain pattern near an area called the Tosmead Copse, which copse is the British word for a forest. It's actually a rather creepy, spooky forest. And these three balls of light kind of began coming towards them from different corners of the field. And they got so petrified, they actually ran out of the field onto the road with their stomping boards and everything, something you normally wouldn't do because you're really not supposed to be out there doing that, you know.
Right.
But here, three big guys with stomper boards ran in panic out of the field after seeing these balls of light. I actually haven't seen the balls of light, you know, in the formations myself. I've seen a lot of good videos, which I think are authentic, that were taken by tourists and other people who happened to be there when they came across. And these balls of light are really strange. They can move up to 200 miles an hour. They seem to be intelligently controlled, and I don't know exactly what they are, but they're attracted to crop circles.
I would hope that there would be video of that.
There is. Yeah. There are about 10 good videos of these balls of light by Alton Barnes and other areas, Barbary Castle, and other good videos that have happened about every year where people are just out there and all of a sudden they see something coming over the horizon. They seem to actually inspect the crop circle. I don't know any other way to describe it. They seem to go over the crop circle, slow down, speed up, they'll either take off, and they seem to have the ability to disappear right in midair. I mean, if you're looking at the video, you'll be watching them, and all of a sudden, it's just, poof, it's gone. Or in other cases, they seem to get smaller as they come towards the camera rather than bigger. And they're not birds or anything that I know about. You know, I can't explain it easily. I don't think anybody can. They're either small UFOs or probes. I mean, and it suggests the possibility that perhaps extraterrestrials are interested in these circles, the ones that they're not even making. They're inspecting them for some reason. And that would suggest that they're doing something energetically that they're interested in. I mean, it's a possibility. It's
possible. Have they come up with, I was looking at some of the ones on your website, and you can link up to Dr. Simeon Hine at coasttocoastam.com, but I was looking at the Devil's Den that you mentioned and the Churchill Formation. And
right.
I'm looking at those. Those are very intricate patterns. Are the people who are designing them and then going out in the fields and stomping them into the grass to try to change the energy of that area and to attract phenomenon, have they developed their own vocabulary in these? Is there a consistency to the ones that they're stomping, or are they just, you know, like spirograph, you know, pop art? Are they just coming up with them? Or have they formed their own kind of, you know, hieroglyphic language?
That's a really good question. And that is still a big mystery to me, exactly where these patterns come from. And I think to some of the circle makers as well, what they've told me is they're actually not sure where these patterns come from. They kind of pop into their mind sometimes, and then they feel compelled to go out and make them. Or in other cases, they just start designing something, and it just kind of manifests itself. Well, and they think, well, can we do this in a field? Is this doable? I've seen some patterns that they say, tell me they can't do yet. They don't quite have the ability to do, but they can draw them on paper. And they do have their own vocabulary and own their own system for actually, I mean, imagine you're in the dark with a group of people and you're making a very complex shape.
I get that. I just mean, I wonder whether these probes of which you speak come down to try to read them and try to figure out what we're saying. Hang on to that answer, and we'll come back to this. We're talking with Dr. Simeon Hine, and we'll continue this conversation with the American crop circles he's been involved with and the phenomena they created with those next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett.